In July 2011, the Review featured a report by Ron Croxton. In July 2011, the Review featured a report by Ron Croxton, who fought at the Battle of Malem. We were contacted by Bill Thompson, who was captured at Malem. He sent an incredible account of life as a POW, which we have reproduced in part. The full version will be included in the Talking Review. Here Bill begins. I was intrigued to read Ron Croxton's article of Malem, as I was there at the same time. I was a member of a commando battalion. We were rushed up from East Africa, our feet hardly touching the ground, and piled into a destroyer. On the 21st of May, we prepared to disembark, but orders were changed due to the deteriorating situation at Malem, and we spent another night cramped up on the ship. On the 22nd of May, we landed at Suda Bay and moved rapidly to take up defence positions in the hills overlooking Suda Bay. The New Zealanders were having a rough time holding off the German paratroops and the glider-borne troops crashing onto Malem airfield and along the beaches. They were soon overwhelmed and had to give up this area and withdraw. What we didn't know was that as we landed, the island was already being evacuated. Across the island on the southern coast was the small harbour of Spakia, where troops were being evacuated. The New Zealanders withdrew through our lines and made haste for the evacuation point at Spakia. We were left to hold the Germans while this was happening. Each night we withdrew, holding the front during the day. The history books say the New Zealanders fought their way back to Spakia, but this is not true. They hightailed it to the evacuation points. We were left to fight the rearguard action to Spakia. We eventually arrived at Spakia at dawn on Sunday the 1st of June 1941, in time to wave goodbye to the last ship to leave the island. In one of the last ships was Brigadier Laycock, the man sent out to form the Middle East Commandos. I will never forget him for abandoning us. Our commanding officer, Lieutenant Colonel Young of the Royal Engineers, was the senior officer left at the harbour. He was ordered to effect the surrender of our part of the island and all the troops there, which comprised our battalion and a few stragglers from other units. We piled our arms in a heap. Our knives went over the cliffs into the sea. A German officer arrived to accept the surrender, and we formed up to be counted. This happened very fast, so that the German Air Force had not been informed, and three Stukas came over and started bombing us. They then flew round to come in and machine gun us. I will always acknowledge the bravery of the German soldiers who stood in front of the planes as they flew in, waving large flags to stop them opening fire. The first one, however, was too quick and started to open fire before the pilot saw the flag. The others saw it in time and veered off. The fire from the first plane went straight through our party and several men were killed. Being a survivor, I finished up underneath a dozen or so bodies. I was very lucky to escape with my life. We were lined up and started the long march back on the road, which we had defended to Malem Airport, and here we saw a scene which gladdened our hearts. All around the airstrip and along the beach for about a mile, it looked like a scrapyard of planes and gliders. They were piled up like cars in a breaker's yard. The invading troops had taken a real bashing, but through overwhelming numbers eventually took the area. The paratroopers suffered incredible losses, so much so that the Germans never used paratroops again. On the road back to Malem, the sole of one of my boots came loose, as we knew they would. The stitching wore out over the rough, stony ground. Part of my sole came away from the upper. I then had to take one of my putties and wrap it round the boot to hold the sole on. Fortunately for many others and me, the British Army had a quartermaster's store in Malem, which held all sorts of items, including clothing and British boots. The Germans allowed us to replace items of clothing and boots as required. Because of the rapidity of the campaign, there was no time to prepare prison camps, and we were herded into a field. There was no fence, but armed guards patrolled round the field. One night I managed to slip through between two guards who were talking together and not paying attention. I made for the hills. In the early hours of the next morning I came into a deserted cluster of buildings. As I walked through, I came upon a German soldier leaning out of a window pointing a rifle at me, or so it seemed. I put up my hands and stood still. I stood there for about 10 minutes. But nothing happened, and he had not moved. So with my hands in the air, I moved closer and soon realized that he was dead. I got out of the place as quickly as I could. Unfortunately, as I got to the end of the building, I ran straight into the arms of two German soldiers who were part of a team searching for dead paratroopers. By various types of language, I told them where I had found the dead one. They were so pleased that they escorted me back to the compound without any fuss. Once again, I was very lucky. Back in the compound, life was very boring and uncertain. We didn't know what our fate was to be. We had very little food, and everyone began to have hunger pains, and dysentery was a problem for all of us. After about 4 or 5 weeks, we were herded out, marched to Suda Bay, and loaded onto an old rust bucket of a ship. We were herded onto the dock, and that was it. We had no idea where we were going. As we pulled out, everyone on board was confident the Royal Navy would come and rescue us, but of course there was no chance as the Navy had withdrawn from the area. The journey took us up through the islands of the Aegean Sea, and our destination was Salonika, now Thessaloniki. It took about 8 days, and I was surprised the old bucket did not sink. After arriving at Salonika Harbour, we disembarked and were marched to our first prison camp. This was a revelation. On Crete, we were handled by the first line troops, paratroops and glider troops, who were decent people and treated us as soldiers. But now we were in the hands of the third raters, whose only qualification was guarding prisoners. The camp was an old school, now surrounded by a double line of barbed wire and armed guards carrying machine guns. Food was non-existent. We received a mug of what was supposed to be soup that consisted of the water from the guards' cooked food, with all the bones, etc., boiled up in it. We had to line up each day with our tin mug to receive a small ladle of this coloured water. It was vile, but it helped to soothe the hunger pains a little. I thought we would all starve to death. On several occasions, some courageous Greek threw bread over the wire and was shot by the guards. On one occasion, a young boy, about 8 years old, threw a loaf over the wire and was shot by a guard. He lay for several hours before the guards would allow anyone to take him away. I did not expect to survive this place. People would do anything for food. The guards found a novel way of amusing themselves at our expense. At the end of the day, they would bring out a large pot that was part filled with bones which had been boiled clean. The bowl was placed in the middle of the schoolyard, and the prisoners were invited to help themselves. With a mass of prisoners round it fighting for the bones, the bowl would be pushed up and down, round and round the yard until it was empty. It was the most degrading sight I have witnessed. It must be remembered that some of the prisoners had been there for some time, as they had been taken prisoner in the early stage of the Greek campaign. We were housed in what would have been the classrooms. There were no beds, and we slept on the floor. Our only comfort was an old horse blanket and some straw commandeered from the Greeks. We were also still in tropical kit. 3 times a day we were paraded onto the schoolyard to be counted. This took anything from 2 to 4 hours to complete. Many of the older prisoners collapsed from exhaustion and malnutrition and had to be held up by their comrades to be counted. I wondered what the hell would become of us, and would we all survive? I'm not sure how long we were there, but after some time we were moved out to the railway station and loaded onto a goods wagon. 40 men were herded into each wagon, which was bolted and locked. Space was very limited. There was just enough room to sit down. Once down, you could not move about. Every time I see films on television showing Jewish people herded into goods wagons, I remember this experience. It is difficult to describe our feelings when being forced into a goods truck with 40 other men. The uncertainty of where we were going and what was going to happen to us was sickening. There was very little room to move about, and everyone wanted to get close to the four air vents high in the sides of the wagons. Here it became the survival of the fittest. Unable to see out of the train, it was difficult to know where we were going, but some observant chaps discovered where we were each time the train stopped. It stopped twice a day in an isolated siding to allow us to disembark to relieve ourselves alongside the train, which was ringed with armed guards. First, we had to collect buckets of water to wash the wagons out, and then we were fed and watered. The food consisted of dry bread made from potato flour and a tin mug of what we called ersatz coffee. It was a coffee substitute made from acorns. It was vile, but it was a hot drink. Dysentery, due to malnutrition, was widespread on the train, and this got worse as time went by. Some were forced to wash their pants out at water troughs at the various stops, shake them into the wind, and put them on again, wet. Escape was, of course, on everyone's mind, but with the trigger-happy armed guards, this was impossible, and during the journey, two men tried and paid the ultimate price. By the time we reached the journey's end, we were completely exhausted, and some could hardly walk and had to be carried. I'm not sure how long the journey took, as we lost all sense of time. The train had a very low priority on the journey and was shunted into sidings to allow troop supply trains to pass through to the various fronts. This was horrendous and had a debilitating effect on most men. The air became stagnant, the smell was revolting, and we felt like rats in a cage. Eventually, we arrived in Krakow, and here we were taken off the train and marched to Stalag 7B, prisoner of war camp on the outskirts of the town. It was a very large camp and housed all sorts of nationalities, Russians, French, Poles, and many others. Life in the camp was not much better than Salonika, but at least we could breathe fresh air, even if it was cold, and cold it was. As we still only had some tropical clothing, which was mostly unsuitable for winter in Europe, eventually our party split up into groups of 1,000 to 2,000 to establish small working camps dotted round the country. About 100 others and I were taken to the railway station and loaded onto the hated trucks and taken to Dubendorf, which turned out to be a small village just outside Berlin. Here we were taken to a new working camp called Stalag 3D, where we were photographed. We had to give our name, rank and service number so that the Red Cross could inform our relatives. We were also given a card stating that we were prisoners of war and allowed to write 10 words telling them we were alive and well. We arrived at Stalag 3D just before Christmas 1941, after a gruelling 5 months trek across Europe. The camp consisted of a large number of huts surrounded by the now familiar double run of barbed wire and guards' towers. Each hut had 16 double bunks housing 32 men. In the centre was an old wood-burning stove, which supplied the heat for the hut. There was one separate toilet block with 10 toilets and a long galvanized trough with 20 cold water taps, so that space was limited and queuing was inevitable. First up, first served was the order of the day. Each bunk was 6x2 and consisted of a normal two-tiered bunk frame, and the flooring of each bunk was 6x2 and consisted of 18 boards 2x4. During our stay here, the boards diminished, as many were used for firewood to keep us warm. Each bunk had a straw pelisse and the horse blanket that we brought with us from Greece. We retained only sufficient boards to support the pelisse, as the rest were burned. When we arrived, we were starving. Dubendorf was a couple of miles from Zossen, which was a large German garrison town similar to Aldershot. We hoped we would get some food, but when it arrived we were in for a shock. Breakfast consisted of a mug of ersatz coffee and what I can only describe as a couple of dog biscuits. Dinner was a concoction of unpeeled potatoes, pearl barley or rice mixed into a very weak soup and a very small piece of bread made from potato flour. Potatoes at this time were the staple diet of the Germans. It was not much, but it helped to keep us alive. At the end of the camp was a large courtyard where twice a day, morning and evening, we would have to parade to be counted. Even the sick had to be carried out to be counted and then carried back again before the parade was dismissed. To begin with, life was very boring in the camp. Some men nearly went round the bend, some would just sit and dream of home cooking and good food. That was the only thing that kept us going. However, this period did not last long. After Christmas, things began to move. Everyone had to go to work. We were split into various groups. Some went into factories, some to road building sites, and some to railway construction sites. The worst off were those sent to the railway sites. It was now January 1942, and Berlin froze. The lads on the railway had to use pieces of rag to lift the rails, as no gloves provided, and many of them got frostbite. I was sent to a factory to work. They took us to the factory in the morning and back to the camp at night. Inside the factory, each German operating a machine was responsible for his prisoner of war helper. I was lucky, as I was sent to a factory making extruded plastic rods. The German worker operating the machine I was on was very kind to us. He was a communist and hated the Nazis. Though he was careful to hide this from his employers, he did indicate his feelings to me. Although he could not speak English and I could not speak German, we got on quite well with sign language. I did not dislike the work, but all prisoners of war hated working for the Germans and helping their efforts. During that time, I received an extra piece of bread for work. The Germans had a system of rationing that had 5 levels of food supply. Level 1 was for fighting the troops. They got the best ration. Level 2 was for workers doing heavy work. Level 3 for light workers and prisoner of war camp guards. Level 4 was for general workers and working prisoners of war. And level 5 was for workers and prisoners of war who did not work. Anyone below this, such as concentration camp inmates, could starve. One day, my operator gave me a train ticket to Berlin from Dubendorf station, which was next to the factory. I suppose I was stupid and naive, but I wasn't thinking straight and got on the train to Berlin. It was amazing that at first nobody challenged me, as I was in a British uniform. I think it was because there were so many in uniform. However, this did not last long. I got off the train and was wandering along looking into shop windows, which had little or nothing in them, when a voice said, "Where do you think you are going?" I looked round and found a German officer. I told him that I was window shopping. This seemed to amuse him, and he asked me where I had come from. I, of course, had to confess that I was from Stalag 3D. He was silent for a while as he considered what to do. Then he said, "Do you see those 2 men in uniform over there with the black hats on? Well, if they pick you up, they will probably shoot you." By this time I was really scared. He continued, "It so happens I am on my way to Dubendorf, so had better escort you back to your factory." Which he did, and I was most grateful to him for his consideration. While I thought there were some good Germans, I got to the factory just in time to be collected by the guards and returned to the camp. The next morning I was taken to another factory and never saw my operator again. Thinking about it later, I suppose he was either shot or imprisoned. I considered myself very lucky to survive. A few days later, the same officer came to the camp and asked the commandant for a small working party to move some office furniture from one office to another. I volunteered. There were three of us, and he took us to Berlin to move this furniture and equipment. We had a whole day in Berlin. This, however, was the last happy outing. While out working, our inmates met many others from other camps, and many had been prisoners of war for a long time, some taken at Dunkirk. During these meetings, they gained a lot of information. We learned of the existence of the Geneva Convention, which laid down rules for governing the treatment of prisoners of war. We had never heard of this convention and were determined to find out more. We also discovered that some camps were receiving food parcels from the Swedish Red Cross. Armed with this information, we asked the camp commandant to arrange a visit from the Red Cross officials, which he agreed to do. This took a long time, and the more information we got from other prisoners of war, the more frustrated we got. One of the rules that we learned was that NCOs and WOs could not be forced to work. There were about 20 sergeant and WOs in the camp, and after a meeting, we agreed not to go to work. The next morning, after the counting parades, the prisoners of war were marched off to work, but we stood still. There was a lot of shouting and waving of rifles when the senior German NCO came out screaming his head off. We call him Big Mouth because he was always screaming and shouting. We tried to explain to him that according to the Geneva Convention we did not have to work. He could not, or would not, understand what we were saying or talking about. As he lined us up in a single stretch line, called out his guards, and indicated that if we did not go to work, he would have us all shot. We were now in a quandary. Do we stick it out or comply? After some discussion, we decided that they would not shoot us, so we stuck it out. Big Mouth was furious and ordered the guards to aim their rifles at us, which they did. We were now very apprehensive. We thought they couldn't shoot us. Many knees were wobbling and mouths were dry. Fortunately, we never found out, as the camp commandant came out, wanting to know what all the commotion was about. We explained our position. He dismissed the guards and said he would investigate our situation immediately. We were then allowed to return to our huts. Big Mouth was furious. Sometime later, we did get a visit from the Swedish Red Cross, and within days we received a consignment of winter clothes and uniforms, which were distributed to all the prisoners of war. These had been salvaged from stocks left behind by the BEF at Dunkirk. True to tradition, the good old Quartermaster Sauls had plenty of stock. Normally, getting supplies from the quartermaster's stores was like getting blood from a stone for our people. Several weeks after this, we were ordered to pack up our belongings and be ready to move out. We were informed by Big Mouth we were being transferred to a camp for non-workers where we would be starved to death. This was taken with a pinch of salt, thinking they couldn't give us less food than we were getting. We were marched to the goods yard near Dubendorf and bundled into the now familiar goods wagons and locked in. So began another tortuous journey. Although the distance by rail was only 250 miles, it took what seemed like a lifetime due to the many stops and diversions. The wagons shunted into sidings at various towns for toilet purposes and whatever passed as food. Finally, we arrived in Regensburg, an enormous railway junction and a vital rail link to all parts of Europe. It received many visits from flights of 1,000 flying fortresses. By the end of the war, it was completely destroyed. We were now put into army trucks and started on a long haul up into the Bavarian Alps to a small village called Hernsfeld, which is now Honenberg, between Nuremberg and Regensburg. This camp was in what could be described as a valley high up in the Bavarian mountains and was called Stalag 383. After our long journey by train and truck, we arrived in Stalag 383 in July or August 1942. The camp consisted of around 400 small wooden huts, approximately 22 feet by 12 feet. In the middle were about six very large huts, Apparently, before the war, each camp was one of Hitler's strengths through joy, pleasure camps. Each hut would house a pure Germanic man and woman who were to produce a child for the German Aryan race. The large huts were obviously used for meetings and schools for instructions and leisure. One hut was large enough to house several tennis courts. There was also a large cookhouse attached to one of the large huts, which was probably used as a dining hall. Now, this camp had been turned into a prisoner of war camp for non-workers. It was surrounded by the usual double rows of barbed wire fencing with watchtowers every 50 yards. The furniture and mod cons used by the Germans had been removed and replaced by 7 double bunks to house 14 prisoners of war. There was a round stove in the middle and a trestle table. Most of the huts were standard, as illustrated, although there were a few that varied slightly. Above the main hut was a large field used for sporting facilities and exercise. It was also used as a parade ground where we were gathered twice a day to be counted, a ritual which took an hour or two. If someone had tried to escape, it could take 3 to 4 hours. At the centre of the camp was a basketball court, which had been scooped out to about 6 inches deep, and in winter it was filled with water, which froze and formed an ice rink to skate on. When we arrived in this camp, there were already some 2,500 men. As the weeks went by, many came in every week. By the beginning of 1945, there were some 5,500 in the camp. It must be remembered that at the beginning of the war, many men from all walks of life volunteered or were called up, and many of these were professionals or semi-professional and very able and intelligent people who quickly became senior ranks. Therefore, the talent in the camp was phenomenal. There were professional actors and musicians, university graduates and teachers, and many more. Once this camp became really established, people started to sort themselves into various groups. The actors and musicians formed a theatre group. The teachers formed a study group in all sorts of subjects, such as English and foreign languages, English literature, history, and many engineering subjects. Agriculture and sheep farming in Britain, Australia, and New Zealand was also taught. There were lessons on sewing and knitting and many other activities. Having been allocated a bunk in one of the huts, which in my case was hut 99, we began to get to know our roommates, whom we would be living with for the next 3 years. My fellow inmates, or Kriegis, as we were referred to by the Germans, as it came from the word Kriegenfanggänger, meaning war prisoner. German guards were, however, nicknamed goons. My fellow Kriegis were from army units and the RAF, who had been shot down over the continent. By the time we had sorted ourselves out and found our way around the camp, it was winter. The winter does not come any harder than the winter in the Bavarian Alps. It was so cold that icicles hung like large stalagmites from the roofs of the huts. This, coupled with the lack of food, made life very uncomfortable. Although the camp had its own cookhouse and was staffed by our own people, who could cook only what the Germans gave them, which consisted of potatoes, half of which were rotten. A mixture of very dried vegetables, ground barley, millet rice, and any other ersatz materials available. Sometimes we received a consignment of bones, minus the meat, from the German abattoir. This gave the soup pretense of real soup, although one had to use one's imagination. Our daily ration was a mug of ersatz coffee, a bowl of soup, and a piece of bread made from potato flour. The bread was in the form of a round, flat loaf, similar in shape to a round cake. Each hut received one loaf per day, which had to be cut up into 14 equal pieces. This was, of course, an impossible task and resulted in many different fare systems. The main one that we adopted was to cut the loaf into 14 pieces as equal as possible. From a pack of cards, 2 suits were selected. A card from one suit was placed on each piece of bread, and a card from another suit was dealt to each man. The one holding the card of the same value took that piece. This prevented any disputes. If this situation had gone on, half the camp would have died of starvation. Fortunately, parcels of food began to arrive from the Swedish Red Cross. As they were neutral, they were allowed to supply food, medication, and other comforts. These parcels were lifesavers, and as time went on, these parcels became more frequent and plentiful. The main Swedish Red Cross representative was called Mr. Berg, and he became the camp hero. He seemed able to obtain anything and everything. He provided books, writing paper, musical instruments and clothing. You name it, he could get it, provided it did not run counter to German regulations. Once the Red Cross parcels started to come regularly, life became more tolerable. Not only were they life-saving, but also items to bargain with. Cigarettes became the standard currency for bargaining, not just between prisoners of war, but also with the German guards. For example, 1,000 cigarettes would purchase a radio, although these were banned officially and were confiscated. When found, we would replace it for another batch of cigarettes. The radio had to be carefully guarded and hidden, operated only when the BBC news bulletin was broadcast. The news was taken down in shorthand by those versed in this field. It was copied in longhand and several copies made. Volunteers would go round the huts and read it out. We knew more about the progress of the war than the guards knew. We did lose a few radios when every so often some security guards from sections such as the SS or the Gestapo visited the camp unannounced and carried out extensive searches. They would fool us into giving them information by pretending to have no knowledge of English when in fact they spoke perfect English. They would speak to one another in German, hoping we would give ourselves away, thinking they did not understand English. They were greatly mistaken. They were, however, very experienced searchers and found many radios which we would replace. This cat-and-mouse game went on for about 3 years, but we were never without the news. The one to suffer the brunt of the discovery of the radio was, of course, the poor old camp commandant. He was threatened on many occasions with a transfer to the Russian front, but fortunately for us, he survived. For all the criticism, he was a real soldier and treated us like soldiers. By 1943, things really began to move. Our hero, Mr. Berg, produced musical instruments of various types, including accordions, trumpets, violins, and sheet music. There were books of all types for the study group and pens and paper. There were also other illegal activities going on, such as the tunnel diggings, which were started and discovered by the goon search parties. Others were immediately started up again somewhere else. The activity was, however, useless, for it was impossible to dig through the hard rock of the Bavarian mountains, but it didn't really stop the enthusiastic ones. Goon baiting was another activity that entailed going up to the guard tower as close as possible and waving packets of cigarettes, jars of coffee and tins of butter that came from the Red Cross parcels. These, denied to the Germans, were used to barter with. The theatre group consisted of many professional musicians and actors, as well as semi-professional and many other enthusiastic members. They produced shows which would be the envy of the West End. The music director was an instructor from Nella Hall, the training school for army musicians. Before we got the printed music, thanks to Mr. Berg from the Red Cross, he wrote the entire score for the different instruments and also the words. The Gilbert and Sullivan operas we put on were HMS Pinafore, The Mikado, and there was a production of Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice, and some of the actors were absolutely fantastic. They also produced such plays as The Importance of Being Earnest, Night Must Fall, and many others. The furniture for these shows was produced by the carpenters, who begged, borrowed, or stole the material. They used the wooden boxes that the Red Cross parcels came in, bedboards and floorboards from the huts. The quality was exceptional. For example, all the wigs for the GNS shows were made from sisal string salvaged from the Red Cross parcels. Some men would sit for hours teasing out the string into fine hairs to make the wigs. Photographs were taken by two professional photographers who were appointed by the commandant of the camp. The photographer's work had to be vetted by him and his staff. They were Hodges and Chase, and their names had to be printed on each picture. Some, however, got through without this. All of the equipment came from dear old Mr. Berg at the Red Cross. Towards the end of the war, the camp commandant would come with his staff to watch performances of some of the plays, particularly the musicals. After a performance, he and his staff would leave, and after a few minutes, the actors and audience would sing the national anthem. The theatre was not the only hive of activity. Like any branch of the services, we had our wide boys, such as Private Walker of Dad's Army. These boys could produce anything, and they even set up their own market stalls in their huts. Just like their counterparts, the illegal traders on Petticoat Lane, these would disappear in a flash should one of the guards come along. These traders, however, were a great source of barter. One could buy or exchange for a few cigarettes almost anything. The Red Cross, of course, were the main source of goods for exchange. If you didn't like jam, you could exchange it on the market for a tin of corned beef or Spam. A word about these Red Cross parcels. Although they were transported and delivered by the Swedish Red Cross, most originated from Canada, and some from home, which explains the interruption in the supply. Some, obviously, went to the bottom of the Atlantic. Each parcel would contain a variety of items, such as small tins of corned beef, Spam, salmon, butter, jam, biscuits, tea, coffee, sugar, and, of course, cigarettes. Nothing from the parcel was wasted. The tins were opened, flattened, then cut up for a variety of purposes. One man even manufactured a train set, among other things. From the tins, the tools were made. Razor blades were the main tool for woodwork, and many unique items were made using only a razor blade. Some items took 2 or 3 years to make. During winter, small groups of prisoners would be taken out into the woods to gather wood for our stoves. During this foraging, many illegal items such as metal would be found and brought to the camp. These were then used to make tools or other items. One was several pairs of ice skates, which were fitted dangerously, I must add, to one's boots with an assortment of straps and string. Despite all the dangers and difficulties, they worked. Several of us learned to skate using the frozen basketball court, which resulted in several sprained ankles. During my 3 years in Stalag 383, I learned more than I had in my life up to then. I had never heard of Gilbert and Sullivan or Shakespeare and so many other great writers. With all the books that were supplied by the Red Cross, I read extensively. Productions of Gilbert and Sullivan and Shakespeare encouraged me to read more, and I read all of Shakespeare's plays. I learned about Charles Darwin and was fascinated by his explorations and his book, The Evolution of the Species. I also read many books by famous authors. I also learned to dance, as we had a professional dance instructor who ran classes for non-dancers. First, we learned all the basic movements and steps, and then, as there were no girls, we had to dance with one another. It did feel very embarrassing, and sometimes we felt a bit foolish, but if one wanted to learn, we had to overcome it and ignore those feelings and get on with it. Despite what people say today, public displays of homosexuality were taboo and ridiculed. Everyone joined in the spirit, and no one ridiculed anyone playing a female part, particularly in the theatre, where there were many female roles. In fact, the men who filled these roles were always given the greatest applause and respect. I often wonder if any of the theatre's three little girls from school, from the Mikado, are still around and if they would remember their performances and the reception they received. I must say that trying to learn the waltz, quickstep, foxtrot, slow foxtrot, rumba and tango had me beat. But I must have learned well, as after I returned home, I was able to get around the dance floor. Having improved my knowledge, it was now time to decide what I would do after the war. The only thing I knew anything about was farming, which I started at the age of 12, or seamanship, which I soon decided against due to my experience on the Thames. Therefore, it had to be agriculture. A fellow prisoner of war, Bill Hayden, who had been an instructor at an agricultural college and had a national diploma in agriculture, ran the agriculture study group. I joined the group. Due to time, space, and books, we were split into groups of 12. My group comprised one South African, three New Zealanders, nine Australians, and one Englishman, me. Many British men considered Australians to be big-headed, rude, and self-opinionated. There is an old saying, if you can't beat them, join them. So I did my utmost to join them. After a while, I got to know them and buried all my preconceived ideas and what I thought about them. In fact, after the first year, I became one of them. I could not have asked for a better friend. The study group covered all the sections in the NDA syllabus. This included botany, general and agricultural sections, zoology, veterinary science and hygiene, farm machinery, surveying and farm buildings. Farm accounts and economics, animal husbandry of all farm livestock, farm crops, pasture and soil husbandry. As the majority of the group were Aussies, it was inevitable that sheep farming would obtain prominence in discussions. It meant I learned a great deal about sheep farming in Australia and New Zealand. The examination papers for the NDA were sent out from England by the Royal Agricultural Society and were due to arrive about April 1945. However, they didn't arrive as our part of the war ended. Bill Hayden gave each one of us a certificate to say that we had studied the NDA syllabus along with an assessment of our progress. This was entered on a prisoner of war certificate that had been supplied by the Ministry of Labour and National Service, and we used it to obtain employment after the war. After I was demobbed, the certificate got me a place at the Sparholt Farm Institute for a two-year course in farm management. During our studies, I got to know my fellow students and colonials, as they were called, and all offered to sponsor me if I wanted to emigrate to either Australia or New Zealand. One New Zealander, Ray Oliver from Canterbury, located on the South Island, was a sheep farmer, and his family had a large sheep farm on the Canterbury Plains, south of Christchurch. He offered to stake me for 6 months if I went. I could have gone to Nelson on the northern part of the island, fruit farming with Madigan. All the Aussies made me a similar offer to fruit farming Queensland and Victoria. But now let me take you back to Hut 99 and my fellow boarders. Some did not study and therefore spent most of their time in arguments on every subject imaginable. There was also a great deal of horseplay and attempts to wind each other up. This was called pet staring and was an unending pastime. One of the pastimes was the removal of some boards so that when the occupant of that bunk sat on it, he went straight through. This was not so bad if it was a bottom bunk, as you merely hit the floor, but if it was an upper bunk, you landed on the lower bunk and possibly went through to the floor. This meant that every time you came in, you had to inspect your bunk, and if you occupied a lower bunk, you had to inspect the upper one as well. The practice had to cease towards the winter of 1944, as foraging parties were stopped and there was no fuel for the stoves. Gradually the bunk boards on each bunk diminished. By the time we were released, the bottom bunkers were sleeping on the floor. Beams were removed from the roof, and chopped up, and any boards on the outside of the huts that didn't hold the hut up were removed. All this was done to supply fuel for the stoves and to keep warm. Christmas came and went, and we were glad to see it go. It was freezing. The school and lecture huts also suffered by the time we were released in April 1945, as several of the huts had no partitions left, and even parts of the roof had been used for firewood. From January up to April, the goons spent little time inside the camp. Most were looking over their shoulders to see if the American army were there. In February 1945, although it was very cold, some of us were walking the exercise field when the sky darkened. We thought we were in for a storm, but over the mountain came the most incredible sight. It was the American Air Force, a flight of 1,000 Flying Fortresses. As they came over the mountain, they appeared so low that we could see the pilots. The roar as they went over was deafening. God, did we cheer! Our throats were dry from cheering and shouting. Everyone rushed out of their huts to cheer. Many had tears in their eyes. The emotion was unbelievable. A few minutes later, we heard the bombs being dropped on the rail junction at Regensburg. The goons were also astonished at this unbelievable display, but they quickly recovered and ordered everyone back into their huts. They kept us there until the evening parade for counting. Although we had cheered the bombers, there was a little sadness in the camp when it was learnt that a train loaded with Red Cross parcels was standing in Regensburg station and was blown to pieces. The German civilians were scrambling all over the place, salvaging what they could for themselves. This was something we had to suffer in return for the destruction of the Regensburg railway junction. By March 1945, things were getting desperate for us as food supplies had begun to dry up, and we once again returned to hungry times. We suffered this in good spirit, because we knew from our usual radio that Peyton's Third Army were not far away. This knowledge was overshadowed by the attitude of the guards, who were becoming increasingly agitated. One never knew how they were going to react. The commandant had assured us that we would remain in the camp until we were released by the Americans. His assurance turned to horror when a large contingent of SS troops arrived and took over the camp. Here, all hell broke loose, and we were told to pack our bags and be ready to march out within 48 hours. This proved impossible even for the SS, who were tearing about like madmen, waving their rifles and firing into the air and hitting Kriegens with rifle butts. After about 3 days, everyone in the camp was ordered to form up with our kit on the sports field to be counted and marched out. Such was the urgency of their mission, they abandoned the count and started to march the whole camp out. Not everyone reached the parade ground. The goons, in their hurry, failed to count and missed quite a few who were determined not to be forced out into the unknown, me being one of them. We found hiding places in all manner of places. Due to the state of the huts, which the Kriegens had almost destroyed, tearing them apart for firewood during the last few days, floorboards had been lifted, beams from the roof removed, and the lecture huts were almost dismantled. There appeared little scope for hiding, but you can't beat a British soldier. Places were found to hide in, including abandoned tunnels underneath the boilers in the cookhouse, others under the theatre stage. For my part, I found a space under the floor of a hut that still had a floor. It was as far from the entrance to the camp and sports field as possible. After the camp had been evacuated, the SS guards, using dogs, started searching the camp for stragglers. Fortunately for us, they were in such a hurry to get away that they only got halfway through the camp before they were ordered out. This was a blessing for us who had hidden. We remained in our hiding places for about 24 hours, and then we began to emerge, hungry, but comparatively happy. Outside the camp was another, smaller compound containing the camp hospital and some offices. During the march out, the goons agreed that the sick prisoners who could not walk or move should stay in the hospital. By the time the evacuation was complete, there were about 1,000 plus left in the camp hospital. After the march out, the number suddenly increased when the men came out of hiding. The hospital was now very overcrowded. Every man slept on his pelisse, but no one complained. By the time I got to the hospital, most of the goons had disappeared. One comic incident, I remember, was a young boy standing guard at the gate. One of our sergeant majors went up to him, took his rifle and said, "Go home, boy, the war is over." You couldn't see his backside for dust. Once all the goons had gone, we were left to our own devices. We knew the Americans were not far away, and we started to explore our surroundings, although we knew that the werewolves were around in the form of small SS people who refused to give up and were scouring the area for food and enemies. This possible threat was ignored, and we extended our exploration. There were four small farmsteads around the area, and these were soon raided for eggs, chickens, pigs and sheep. At one stage, I remember there were six sheep carcasses and three pig carcasses hanging from the beams of the hospital roof. Some men became very ill through eating so much fresh meat after being deprived of it for so long. We heard the sound of gunfire, but it came, then seemed to pass by. Obviously the Americans did not know where we were, so several intrepid adventurers were selected to go down the mountain to the main road and stop the troops to tell them where we were. At 4 p.m. on the 22nd of April, 1945, a date that will be forever engraved on my memory, two Americans drove into the camp in their jeep. Then all hell really did break loose. They were mobbed, lifted out of their jeep and carried round and round. They must have thought they had been mistaken for royalty or film stars when the notebooks and pieces of paper were produced for their autographs. I got an autograph from one. The atmosphere was electric and extremely emotional. Men had tears in their eyes and some actually cried. Never will I forget that day as long as I live. The next day a contingent of American troops arrived and set up camp beside us. They started to distribute food packets of field rations, which contained biscuits, tubs of butter, jam, peanut butter and packets of cigarettes. So plentiful were these packs that the American soldiers opened them, took out the cigarettes and threw the rest away. We were appalled at such a waste, and later we felt a little disgusted, but then we were not used to extravagance. I often wondered what happened to the 5,000 prisoners of war who were marched out from the camp, and have heard since that they had a very rough time. After a few days, the Americans arranged transport out for us, and we were left in army lorries driven by black American soldiers. The drive down the mountain was horrendous, and I have never been so scared in my life. We thought the drivers were mad and bent on suicide. As we took the hairpin bends, the lorry's inside wheels lifted off the ground. Some men were injured when the truck got too close to the cliff face. How we got down in one piece was a miracle, and we gasped with relief when we got to the bottom. We were taken to Nuremberg Airport, or what was left of it, and loaded into American transport planes and flown to Brussels, where we were transferred to the RAF's Lancaster bombers and flown to Great Missenden in Buckinghamshire, where we were encamped for 2 days whilst we were registered and given transport vouchers and sent on 6 weeks' leave.